Hello, Catherine here. If you're listening to my podcast because you're a fan of wintering, the good news is that my new book, Enchantment, is available now. It's a book about how we can find a way to reconnect with a world that's sometimes hard to live in and even to find magic there. It's available in all good bookshops and please support your local indie if you can. For more information, you can go to catherine-may.com/enchantment. Happy reading.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's the end of a long day at my desk. I've had a lot to catch up with, but it's been on Easter holiday. So I've been hanging out with him, which is always lovely. And also my office has been decorated over the last couple of weeks. Well, actually, it feels like longer than that because I started decorating my office and then it got overwhelmed with like stacked up boxes where I was doing other stuff in the house, as is always the case in my office, incidentally. I'd like to rather bitterly say that my office is the dumping ground for the rest of the house. I dream of a room of my own. And then I couldn't really get in there. And then a nice man called Dan came and painted it for me last week. And then, of course, I had to clean it all out again. It feels like a long time since I could get back in there and not be huddled on the dining room table trying to make the best of things. And today I got back in and it's looking lovely. There's finally more than enough space for all my books, which is something of a first for me. I don't know what to do with all the space. It's really exciting. So, yeah, I caught up on a few things today. But now I've just come down to the beach to catch the sun for a little while. I've got my summer dress on. I'm feeling springy. I think I'm having a time of sorting things out at the moment. I'm thinking about my working space, and I've been busy with loads of other things too. I've got a strange time ahead for the next year in that my book is ready to go and it's a year until it's published. So that leaves me with an odd piece of time because it's too early to write the next book. I write books in quite a short period of time if I can. It's too soon. And yet, what will I do? What will I be if I'm not writing a book? There's this fear that rises up in me that I'll forget how to write somehow or that I'll lose the knack. And I think, in a way, that's a valid fear. It's something that's a muscle, writing or any creative practice. You have to keep moving, you have to keep doing it. So I've been looking for what I should do for the next while. I've got a few thoughts. Every night I go to bed and I dream a different novel. It's really funny. My brain is trying to make helpful suggestions for me. Maybe I'll write one of them, who knows. Had a really good one about a hotel last night. We'll see. But also, I have been sorting out all my other things too. I'm revamping my newsletter, which I tried to revamp last year and didn't do it very well. So I'm doing another revamp. You'll see that soon. And I'm working with an amazing illustrator who is going to make it look beautiful, which it hasn't before. So excited to show you that. Watch this space, I'll let you know. And I guess I'm just trying to set everything to rights, get my bookshelves in order. Sometimes you got to do that. It's lovely to be down here. I'm standing by the edge of the sea next to one of the wave breaks that's covered in beautiful bladderwrack seaweed, which is what I have tattooed on my arms now. And I've just noticed by my feet there's an open clamshell. I'm going to pick it up. One of the double ones that's still attached. It's a beautiful colour pink inside, like a butterfly. I'll never stop enjoying seashells and taking them home. Which brings me neatly to the conversation you're about to listen to with the author and spiritual teacher, Cole Arthur Riley, who it was just such a pleasure to talk to. I wasn't sure if she'd say yes when I asked her, and I was so thrilled that she did, because it's wonderful to connect with people who've got such a beautiful engagement with the world. And she so often talks about wonder in her book, This Here Flesh, and about how wonder can flow through everyday things and make the everyday luminous, and how in many ways that's so much more important than these very distant ideas of a grand God who is making the rules in some faraway place. Anyway, I think you'll love her. Do take a listen, and I'll see you again in a little while. Cole, welcome to the Wintering Sessions. I am so thrilled to have you on the podcast for loads of reasons, actually. Partly because I just loved your book.
Thank you.
But also, I wanted to talk to you because, you know, I'm English, as you can well tell. And we have a very awkward relationship with talking about spirituality in the UK. We are self-conscious about it and we are avoidant of it. And I know that it's really hard to publish books about any kind of spiritual issue in my country because even like religious folk don't tend to engage in that conversation. It's this thing that we're very embarrassed about. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to get better about talking about it and about hearing other people's perspectives too. And I feel like Americans are much better at this than us.
Maybe.
I know it's kind of complicated, but there isn't mm-hmm. that absolute kind of sucking in of breath and drawing away.
Yes.
That we certainly have. And I was laughing on Sunday because the Archbishop of Canterbury, like in his Easter sermon, made like this proclamation, not proclamation, maybe that's the wrong word, but said that God would judge the government for the way they're treating Ukrainian refugees. And there was this kind of big political consensus in the UK that he shouldn't have brought God into it. And I thought, well, that tells you a lot about where we are in the UK, that we don't even think the Archbishop of Canterbury should bring God into anything. Right. Which I is a nice summary of, of what we're like here. But you are the founder of Black Liturgies, which, can you describe that a little for us? Because it's something I follow on Instagram and it's this very beautiful account.
Sure. Yeah. Well, first I'll just say, you know, on the opposite end of the spectrum, we have Americans who are just really excited to have a religion be supreme and to kind of triumph. And so, yeah, sadly, I think many Americans kind of use it as an excuse to talk maybe too much in order to have their spiritual belief system seem kind of larger than. And so it's really complicated. And so when I started Black Liturgies, I think I've always been kind of aware of that tension, that temptation to make anyone's spirituality supreme and to make spirituality more about being right than about conveying, you know, what it means to be human, what it means to love and what it means to grieve. I think there's always this temptation to kind of like prove one's rightness and capital T truth. And I wanted to resist that when I started Black Liturgies and kind of have this spiritual space that maybe felt more liberating in a way that would allow for, you know, a transparency that I'm speaking out of a Christian tradition. I've been formed in a Christian tradition, but I never want to cling too tightly to any doctrine. I don't necessarily feel, people sometimes are frightened by this, but I don't necessarily feel an allegiance to Christianity. Mm. I more so feel this allegiance to the questions of what it means to be human, you know, a kind of fidelity to being a person that asks questions of the spiritual. I try to convey that in Black Liturgies, and I connect and center Black emotion and Black literature in the Black body. And I connect that with the spiritual practice of written prayer and usually have some kind of breath exercise as well.
Yes, breath is so important to you. And it's part of this sense that you're writing about day-to-day survival, about the kind of realities of living and that kind of embodied experience.
Yes. And I think, I mean, because of how I've chosen to share Black Liturgies initially through Instagram and still primarily through Instagram, I felt like I really, you know, needed to be responsible with people's bodies, because I know what social media can do. You know, I know what these algorithms were created by very brilliant people who have learned how to keep us disembodied and scrolling. And I thought, if I'm going to kind of use this as a tool, I want to be able to try to draw people out and into their own bodies. And, you know, whether they practice it or not, I wish I could tell, you know, but I think there's something of a dare in it, you know, like it's daring you when you, you know, scroll past it and something's telling you inhale and exhale. It's at least I find it difficult not to practice that. So I incorporate breath a lot.
And having that pause in that stream of information that we're scrolling through, it does. Your posts always make me just stop just for a moment in my endless scrolling, because they do invite me to do something very deliberately with my body, which I need to do. I live in my head all the time. I'm a writer. You know, that's what I do.
Yes.
It's very hard to find that contact with the physical, corporeal world sometimes for me.
Yes, I absolutely resonate with that. I can just be in my head for hours and completely forget. And when I kind of come to, I realize like my shoulder is hurting or my back is hurting just because of the way I've been sitting, you know, but I've been so kind of out of my own body, I wasn't able to sense it. Anyways, I'm just realizing these things about myself that have been true all my life, but I'm starting to put language to them and realizing so much of it is grounded in disembodiment. And
and it's all connected. Well, let's start talking about you, because you're such a storyteller. And what I loved in This Here Flesh was this sense that your stories and your family's stories are all completely intertwined, as if their stories are your stories, like as if you kind of inherited them genetically somehow.
Yes.
And I loved this idea that you were a child who didn't really speak much, who chose to be mute for the longest time. Can you tell us a little bit about that and set the stage for me?
Sure. So you can picture, you know, 4 to 6 year old Cole was very, very shy, a very anxious child. I would walk around with my ears just tucked into my shoulders and very distinct from people in my family. So my family is just, they're lovely and loud and boisterous and chaotic. And very charismatic and winsome and charming. And I am perhaps the only reserved person in my family, reserved and quiet. So, you know, there are these home videos of everyone in the kitchen laughing and, you know, carrying on. And then the camera just pans to Cole sitting at a windowsill, you know, staring sadly and longingly out the window. Or I could be found in closets, kind of tucked away, reading Goosebumps books or things like that. So I was very reserved and very solitary. But a lot of that was born of anxiety as well. So I had a fairly common childhood anxiety disorder called selective mutism, and I would find myself unable to speak around certain groups of people or strangers. And so I have a lot of memories of even wanting to speak, but feeling this bodily resistance, you know, and feeling like I couldn't say what I needed to say. I tell a story in the book about getting my hand stuck in one of our screen doors, and my father had friends over, and my aunt was in the living room, and there were people I didn't know in the house. And so I didn't cry out for help, you know. I'm just this little girl just writhing and, you know, knowing,
quietly being in terrible pain.
Yes, just praying that his eyes just come over this way and see me. And yeah, if you read the book, you know that it's my sister who in the end finds me and leads me in this kind of really sacred childlike screaming session in the backyard with freeze pops. But yeah, yes. I've had a very complicated relationship with language since I was little, and I did speech therapy for a number of years and remained pretty shy and not incredibly verbal through high school, really. So it's been a long journey.
Yeah. And when you were, I think, 8, your hair turned gray as well, because you were so anxious. You were such an anxious little thing.
Yes. Yes. Oh, man. I tell people this and they're just the disbelief. But yeah, I had gray hair from just such a young age, and poor me, because, you know, all I wanted was my own invisibility, sadly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a little black girl sprouting gray hairs, you know, at such a young age, just everyone's eyes drawn to me, even if they weren't, you know, it certainly felt like it was, because it's the things that are distinct about us that are our earliest alienators, you know. Yeah. And so I had a lot of shame and alienation and anxiety that I was carrying in my body. And yeah, the hair did not help.
An old head on young shoulders, literally.
Wow.
Yeah. But at the same time, your family are incredible talkers and storytellers. And they sound like an amazing bunch of people. You just to read about them, you just want to be in their company. It just sounds like this lively household. And I mean, I was fascinated by your dad, and I was fascinated by your grandmother. But I'd love to get you talking about your dad, because, I mean, it seems to me like he was a talker above all else. He was like a persuader.
Yes.
And someone who could kind of coach you into endless acts of making yourself braver and better and bigger.
Yes. I mean, my father is so smooth. He's just smooth, smooth, smooth. He's not even the kind of smooth where you kind of sense that someone's maybe selling you something, or, you know, it's not quite like that. It's just, he has a way of making you feel so yourself, you know, so comfortable with however you present to him. He's can adapt, you know, he can adapt to kind of speak your language and even speak your body language. And I grew up just watching him and watching this unapologetic kind of metamorphosis that just happened again and again and again. And I'd hear him answer the phone, and it sounded like he had 6 different voices, you know. And so he's lovely. He's always been a hustler since he was a child, working multiple jobs, you know, shoveling sidewalks and cleaning this laundry facility in the evenings. And so he's always had a bit of hustle in him, not a restful spirit by any means, and certainly not a reader. A lot of people kind of assume that I'm from a family of readers, or my father will be the first person to tell you, you know, he's not a reader nor a writer. He doesn't quite have the patience for books. But I think because of who he is, he recognized that in me. And so he adapted our entire household into being this family of written words. And so he would bribe me and my siblings to write little poems or short stories, and or we could do that to get out of chores, you know, if we didn't want to vacuum that day. Yes, brilliant, you know, because if you have a choice between wiping baseboards and, you know, writing a poem on the color yellow, you'll choose the poem probably. And so he found a way to, and that also brought my siblings into my form of expression, you know.
Right, it brought you together.
Exactly, because they frankly didn't need it in the way that I did. They were all very verbal, very charismatic children, and very comfortable in, well, as comfortable as children can be in their own skin. Mm. And so my father very wisely kind of saw something distinct in me and was able to rework our family culture and our kind of household spirituality to look different.
It's amazing. He comes across in your book as a incredibly smart, intuitive parent who was constantly working with you in the way that you wanted to work rather than straining against you. It's such a rare thing.
I do. The older I get, the more I realize how rare it is, you know, to have a father that really takes you seriously. I always felt like he really took my emotions seriously, even if he didn't understand them. You know, there'd be times where I would just be crying and I wasn't able to articulate, or I don't think I even understood where the sadness was kind of coming from. Mm. And I think it really tormented him in a way, but he always took it very seriously. It could have been a situation where, you know, when a child is unable to explain why they're sad, you kind of brush it away, you know, and say, okay, it must not be that serious. But yeah, to have an adult and a guardian who can really pay attention, I think is a gift.
A huge gift. I love the story of you getting stuck halfway up a rock, like a climbing wall.
Yes.
And you please, like, you tell the story rather than me.
Okay. Yes. I mean, this is Arthur family lore. Like, this is, you know, what everyone's
comes up every Christmas.
Yes, exactly. When everyone's going around the table and everyone has a story, this is mine. So my father and my stepmom, they used to work at this, well, they volunteered at this annual rib cook-off that would last about a week. And my siblings and I thought they were very, very important because, you know, everyone knew who they were and they were kind of in charge of running the whole thing. And which in hindsight, it's a very big responsibility and says something about their hearts and their intuition. But so there are all kinds of activities at this thing and there's this giant rock wall. To me, it felt giant, at least. I mean, when I tell you I was a scared child, I mean, I'm just a scared person. And I don't say that in a self-deprecating way. I think fear can be really beautiful and sacred. And I'm not ashamed of that. But I am a very scared person. And my sister is quite brave. And so she, you know, drags me on this rock wall. I get halfway up it and I'm just sobbing. I feel like I cannot move. I cannot take, my legs are shaking. You would like, in my mind, this was the end. This was death. And, you know, I
just
couldn't
stuck
go
there forever.
Up.
That was the end
yes,
of it.
Yes. My little arms were shaking and my sister, you know, she goes up and down easy. And she eventually has the worker call my parents on the walkie talkies. So my dad, you know, races over in the golf cart or whatever. And, you know, instead of coaching me from the ground, which would have been maybe the reasonable thing to do, he just straps, he harnesses in and, you know, gets on belay and he's up there. Next thing you know, he's next to me and he's like, you know, coaching me to the top, going reach and step and use your legs and not your arms until we hit the buzzer. And in my memory, at least, whenever I hit that buzzer, just the crowd was just frenzied, you know, like joy. And I mean, such a strong core memory of joy, I think, and of belonging and real pride, yeah. pride in my body. You know, I was very detached. I mean, we've talked about this a bit. I was really detached from my body as a child. I didn't know my body could do, you know, such a thing. And so I felt pride in my body as well as this connection. Yeah.
That's amazing. I have a very similar memory, which I think is why I relate to that story so much, of going up a mountain with the girl guides and getting stuck at the top, like just having that feeling of my legs falling away underneath me and lying on the ground like clinging to a rock.
Wow.
And saying, that's it, I can't come down again. Like I literally felt like the mountain could crumble underneath me and everything was going to fall down and I couldn't move. Mm. And I was walked down by an entire girl guide troop, like literally taking me one step at a time. And I know exactly how you felt in that moment. And there's sometimes being the fearful one, which I definitely always was, is a real privilege because you learn what it is for people to take care of you. And I don't think everyone learns that lesson until it's forced on them when they're older and they resent it. And I like there's something yes. about being taken care of that's a real, it's an aspect of our humanity that we don't like to think about, but that it's an important one. It comes to all of us eventually.
Yes. Oh, I mean, I think that's beautifully said. So much humility, I think, comes, is born out of fear. And I also think, you know, for people like us, the scared ones, you know, I think there's a kind of intuition that is grown in us because maybe we're more attuned to those inner stirrings, more attuned than the person who maybe is very quick to want to triumph and, you know, conquer the fear, you know, very different than the sensation of wanting to win. I think the sensation of fear is more of a listening, you know, which I think lends itself really well to intuition as we age.
Yeah, definitely. And in some ways I feel a little sorry for people who are so afraid of those moments. You know, like I get fearful of heights and spiders and all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But what I don't get afraid of is being afraid. Like that's okay for me. I don't mind being vulnerable. And I'm really glad to have trust in being vulnerable because to me that is a life skill actually. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And a vital one.
Yes, I absolutely agree. I mean, I talk about this in This Year Flesh a bit, but I think fear can be such a protective force, you know, and it gets such a bad rap, really. But if you think about it, you know, fear is the thing that keeps us from, you know, jumping from building to building, from, you know, putting our hand over the flame. There's this really protective force that I think that can be at the heart of it. You know, when you talk about that being cared for, there's also a sense of being protected and kind of habitual realization that you are worthy of protection, you know, and worthy of that care and that nurturing that I think comes out of those fear experiences.
Yeah. Like it's interesting to tell your dad's story in that context because he had his own huge vulnerabilities as well as being this like exceptionally mindful parent. He also had his kind of Achilles heel, didn't he, which was addiction.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there comes a point in the book when you have to take care of him as well.
Yes. Oh, that's, it's true. There's a shift that happens. You know, my father, he lived with his addiction for a number of years in secret. He's very, very shrewd, you know, very smart and aware of his own presence. And so he was able to kind of operate in a kind of hiding for quite some time. And so, and, you know, there's so much to say about illusions and kind of how enchanting they are, especially as a child, you know, and there's something beautiful in that enchantment, but also something really devastating when like a veil is lifted and you realize I'm not the only one afraid. And I'm not the only one who needs protected and care and kind of nurturing. And so it's really complicated to encounter that, I think, in our heroes and those who we want to believe to be superhuman. But I think I started to love my father so much deeper when I recognize him as human, you know, human. Yeah. And there was something really painful, but also healing about that shift and how I viewed him.
Mm. And I loved how compassionately you wrote about that, you know, like in other writers' hands, that would have been a da-da-da moment, like, but actually, yes, as it turns out, my father was not who I thought he was, you know, that kind of thing. And actually, the way you describe it, it was just another aspect of this man that you found incredible and a vulnerability that he needed help with. And that doesn't diminish him in your eyes or our eyes as we read.
Yes. And I'm just so relieved anytime someone says that that's how they've read it, because that just something that really haunted me as I was writing. How do I really complicate someone's humanity and not have them be diminished to any one kind of story or diminished to kind of a plot, you know, a narrative arc?
Yeah, absolutely.
Actually complicate it so that there's many kind of tensions and releases. And, you know, this is significant and I don't want to, you know, diminish that. But I also don't want my father's story to just be eclipsed. And so I took extra care, I think, in those early chapters, the first half of the book, to really help people fall in love with my father and my grandmother, how I fell in love with them and am in love with them. And so that by the time they come to the basement, by the time they arrive to the realization, it's not this unmasking, you know, it's kind of like more so like turning a leaf over in your hand and you're seeing a different part, you know, you're privileged to more.
Yeah, it's a deepening of a very human story about a family who didn't always know how to love themselves, you know, and who have existed in a world that's been incredibly hostile to them, and how we cope, actually, how we get through.
Yeah, and I've noticed, I mean, as I wrote, I noticed so much overlap in my father's story, my grandma's story, and my story in terms of, you know, hiding as a coping, a form of coping and dislocation, you know, this kind of solitariness as a coping. And yeah, it was really eye-opening to encounter myself in my father, you know, in my father's story. And I'd always thought of us as so different, you know, because he's so charming. And like we talked about, he's this kind of character, this lovely character. And when I wrote, I realized the distance between us is really not that great.
And I feel like that informs the way you talk about God, as you conceive of them as this charismatic figure who is with you in your weakest, degraded, difficult moments, rather than is judging you, like who's walking alongside you.
Yes. Yeah, you know, I try to. I'm just trying to become more honest about what I really think about the divine. And like the truth is, I really do think about God as this familial, this kind of tender familial existence, maybe, and kind of embodying these different aspects of a family, certainly not a nuclear family necessarily, but, you know, I think about God as a mother, I think about God as a child. And so I wanted to express that. And I've never really resonated with a very formal and demanding God.
Well, it just seems to me that lots of people use that God to tell people off for stuff that they themselves don't approve of. You know, that God is like a toolkit, you know, that you throw at people you don't like. I mean,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. As a way, as opposed to a way of making sense of who you are and how you move in the world and what your relationship to other people. There's a way, I think, to experience God as kind of a lens, the divine as a lens to help you see the world and see yourself clearly, you know, see the barn swallows, you know, in the backyard clearly. I think there's a way to experience the divine that's like that, as opposed to this, you know, instruction manual and
right and wrong, like a really fixed sense of right and wrong that isn't in any way contingent on what's coming up for you at the moment and what you're having to deal with.
Exactly.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm just interrupting you for a moment to ask if you'd consider subscribing to my Patreon. Friends of the Wintering Sessions get an extended edition of the podcast a day early, the chance to put questions to my guests, a monthly bonus episode, and exclusive discounts on my courses and events. Most of all, you help to keep the podcast running. To find out more, go to patreon.com/Catherine May. Do take a look. Now back to the show.
So I want to hear about your grandma too. I'm always telling stories about my grandma. They are irresistible people, grandmas.
They are.
She sounds remarkable. I mean, what she endured and what she was able to become is a story in itself, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's really hard to think about, you know, to really think about the things that she's lived through. You know, I was just talking to my sister about this the other day, the just trajectory of her life, and then marking the trajectory of American history alongside that life. And she's been through a lot in many ways. She went to live with people who weren't her parents at a very young age because her mom was having struggles with her mental health and was in a hospital for a long time. And ultimately the family decided her mother couldn't raise her. So she went to live on this, she went from Manhattan, Harlem, the city, to this very rural farm area with people who were quite cruel and, cruel in the name of God, actually, if we want to talk about using God as like this manual. And really verbally abusive in every way you can imagine, and had to make sense of herself and make sense of who she wanted God to be in that climate. And eventually, she leaves and is kind of freed from that, but it took a toll. And as her granddaughter, you want to believe that you completely kind of transcend these difficult things. And, by the time you're 70, the language, you've conquered them maybe, to see them so clearly in her, as her granddaughter, to see these things that this abuse that had left its mark on her, sleeping with the door open, sleeping in a chair and never a bed. There's so much tragedy that I thought was just who she is, as a person. Mm-hmm. And as I got older and learned more of her story, I realized we're born out of a lot of trauma. But in ways she did experience a kind of liberation. She created this family. We called her the queen matriarch. And we would always, we'd say this thing like, protect the matriarch at all costs. And she created this family of real love and, not perfection, but of love and our own kind of spirituality. It wasn't necessarily overtly Christian, or we didn't grow up going to church or anything like that, or reading the Bible, but there was a sense in the family that she created that you know, our humanity matters and how we relate to, you know, ourselves and our interior worlds, that matters. And so out of, you know, her own formation, the fact that she was able to then form, you know, this sacred community of love and tenderness is so, so special. And
she shared, I mean, you came to share her history yourself. Like it's the same as your dad in a way. Like she had this ability to be vulnerable with you and to be human with you and to allow that exchange almost, which I don't think everybody has with their grandparents, to put it lightly.
Yes. I mean, I'm not sure. So I started, you know, interviewing people in my family a handful of years ago, elders, and trying to preserve their stories and their memories. I was kind of plagued by this thought of, you know, this lack of artifacts and in my family history. And so anyways, I started out on this personal project just to collect stories. And I would say it wasn't truly until then that I think she really let me in. You know, it was almost like she needed a reason and she needed an invitation so that it didn't feel like a burden, which is quite sad. But as it happened, you know, as I began interviewing her and when I decided that her stories would be in the book and she agreed to that, I would talk to her on Saturdays and just ask her question after question. And this intimacy was born. And I really don't think I would have ever told her about my own abuse as a child. And I don't think I ever would have had that with her had it not been for, you know, that ritual of storytelling and that kind of weekly nearness. And so, yeah, I'm really grateful for how that shows up in the book. It was a very last minute addition. I'm talking last minute edit. And I did it
really?
Because...
Yeah, it's one of those bravery moments in writing.
Yes, that can be an editor's nightmare. But I just knew, you know, in order for... There was so much unsaid, and there still is, that I think there's kind of a beautiful withholding that I was trying to practice. But at the same time, I knew that there were just a few things I needed to say so that people would truly understand why it's our stories, you know, being told, and this true, I mean, this connection that wouldn't make sense.
Why it's so shared, and the power of that sharing and that shared burden, and how you can integrate all of those shameful things that you know, you feel so terrible about, which you shouldn't feel shameful, but you do, by having a shared story. And it seems to me in your book that what you're saying is that those stories flow in both directions. It's not just about you inheriting your family's stories, but you're sharing them back to them. And there's a kind of melding that happens there.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, there's this moment that I share in the book. So my grandmother, she actually passed away during the editing phase of the book, during the final edits, in fact. And so there's this story I tell where I visit her in the hospital. She had fibrosis of the lung and was having trouble breathing. And she had just come out of medically induced coma, which, if anyone knows anything of that, it takes a lot of your, it takes a lot of your capacities away. It takes time to recover your speech and your fine motor movements and all kinds of things. So anyways, I'm sitting on her bed and she's just talking and telling stories, but she's still just a bit out of it. And so she's using we and I and you and they and like her, it's all kind of jumbled. And I truly, because of so much overlap in our stories, I wouldn't know. There were times I didn't know if she was talking about my story or hers.
Right.
And I just rested in that. I there was something about the moment that I thought, this doesn't need clarification. Like, I'm just going to let her tell it, you know? And
And she says, we did good, doesn't she? We did
good. Yes. Yes.
Together.
She was such a poet. She said, we did good. We took the sweetest part of the fruit and we cut it off.
Yeah.
That's what she said.
It's incredible.
We took the sweetest part of the fruit and we cut it off.
And I'd love you to make the link for us towards your work is about the sort of the huge burden of Black history that rests, or Black American history in particular, that rests on you as this latest generation, and how you come to carry that as the heir to this huge kind of terrible story that hangs over you as a member of a wider community.
Yes. I mean, it would be so hard to tell our family's story without telling the story of Blackness. Mm. You know, not that our generational story can encapsulate it, but, you know, I just wouldn't be telling a true story. And so I do go there in my work with Black liturgies and in this here flesh. Mm. I wanted to get out a kind of spirituality that didn't come at the expense of my Blackness. You know, I have belonged to spiritual spaces that kind of demanded that I leave my Blackness at the door, so to speak, in order to enter this larger community. And it was really painful and damaging. So in this year flesh, I'm really protective of that. I'm really protective of maybe the unique ways, the particular ways that my family has come to understand the spiritual, not in spite of Blackness, but because of it. You know, what are our rituals? What are our, also, what are our coping, you know, what are our coping habits? But yeah, what are our rituals? What are our loves? What are our desires? You know, all of those things that are so formed, so informed by our Blackness, they have room, you know, they have room in the conversation as opposed to being kind of pushed down. I try to let it breathe.
Yeah, and you say a lot there about there's a moment when your Bible teacher says to you, you know, God's in your heart, and you rebel against that. You're like, no, I don't want God there. I want God like at the corner of the street, kind of, you know.
Yeah.
I want that presence in my everyday life as I live it, rather than in some kind of idealized future space that in which I am perfect.
Yes, this kind of immaterial, vague, you know, language of the heart. It's very white evangelical, that language. And I don't think that people who use it always understand, you know, what they sound like to other people. I think there's nothing wrong with having your particularized, you know, language, but when you're completely unaware, you know, that your language doesn't translate to an outsider, I think it says a lot about your spiritual practice. But yeah, I was in college when I first started hearing, you know, again and again, all this language about inviting Jesus into your heart. And it all felt very imprecise and very immaterial to me, in a way that I felt like I had to leave my body behind, you know. It felt like there was a complete disregard for the flesh, for my embodied existence. You know, she wasn't talking about my physical heart, you know, certainly not. She was talking about this
not
idea.
Even your actual beating raw heart is allowed.
Exactly. I don't blame her, you know, she was a maybe 21 herself, and, you know, ascribing to these things that we say and these beliefs that we say that we believe, but we're not actually sure, we're not actually convinced we believe them. You know, I think she just like I certainly didn't have the confidence to say it out loud, you know, all of those doubts and all of that resistance in me. It was an inner resistance. But the temptation of belonging is so large, you know, it looms so large that you'll say you believe anything, you know, to belong. I mean, I truly believe that that is such a huge factor in what we say we believe or don't believe. It comes down so often to belonging. And so what does it mean to create spaces, spiritual spaces, where your belonging is not predicated on what you believe, you know, about on what you think about any given thing, you know? What does it look like to create spiritual spaces that you can wake up one day and think an entirely different thing about God, and you're no less, you know?
And there's something that you say right at the beginning of the book that struck me so hard, which I'd been thinking about a lot, because, like, as you might know, I've written about my autism diagnosis, which was like 5 years ago now. And that, you know, that for me was a moment when I thought, a bit like you, about having been a quiet person all my life who hasn't been allowed to be quiet, and how I needed to retreat from the world. But during the pandemic, I kind of came to the end of a cycle of that and realized that even I could get lonely, and that actually my creative life doesn't exist in a vacuum. And you write so beautifully at the beginning about how, like, white religious thinking has often told you that silence and retreat and isolation are where you enter into spiritual communion, but that actually you say, to quote you, I cannot sustain belief on my own. And I'm learning that sometimes the most sacred thing to do is to shout, that spirituality exists within community. I think we can use that interchangeably with creativity there, maybe.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's beautiful. And to allow that for yourself too. I mean, I used to think that solitude and silence were, you know, just the pinnacle, the complete pinnacle of spiritual wisdom. And I mean, I do still find spiritual wisdom in them, but I'd completely kind of constricted my spiritual experience to those things. And I think if it's only silence, you know, I have a very complicated, we've talked about my childhood, I have a very complicated relationship with silence from my childhood. I have a very complicated relationship with silence as a Black woman in America and, you know,
and being silenced.
Exactly. And so there's a real complicated relationship that I feel I must acknowledge, and I have to allow for a diversity of things. I need a kind of silence that isn't done to me, you know, or that isn't impressed upon me, but that's chosen. And I need a kind of solitude that is only coming because I feel deeply grounded in a community and people who love me and understand me and can pull me back in, and or else my solitude becomes just a practice in dislocation, you know? And so I'm starting to realize all of these things about my contemplative practice and trying to expand how I think about them.
Funnily enough, I've got like a quite an angry passage in my new book about the way that silence and the kind of the tradition of men going off in a kind of monastic way to contemplate and therefore claiming the spiritual high ground because they've thought about this stuff harder, is like a way of systematically excluding most women who are busy with these mundane duties of caring, like whatever generation you're caring for, we're always looking after somebody. And how that's been weaponized against us, and how I weaponized it against myself after I had my son and I couldn't keep up with my like very rigid meditation practice that I'd made for myself that only, you know, allowed, you know, had to be twice a day. It had to be after breakfast, but before I started, oh, sorry, before breakfast, but you know, like blah, 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 blah. It went on and on. Like it was really rigid. And for ages, I felt like I couldn't therefore access this and actually, it's only really recently that I've come to realize that I have to remake it for myself and that those people could learn a lot from me, actually. You know, there are depths of experience that they haven't reached if they've never looked after anyone and have only been looked after.
Yes. we could talk about this for hours because I completely agree. Just the level of the sheer privilege and just being able to like extract oneself and, you know, go off. It's so, you know, maybe they've thought about a thing more, but you've lived it, you know, you're living it. You're feeling it, hopefully. Mm. And I think the way that I'll say white intellectualism has situated itself in the world and white male intellectualism has situated itself in the world is that, you know, the thinking is, yes. is that's where the, that's the top of the hierarchy. That's the most important thing, you know?
And everyone else must rally to facilitate that thinking for them.
Yes, exactly. and you have to prove yourself, you know, you have to prove yourself as thoughtful you have to prove that you can think well about being kind before you know,
go out and
show
do that.
That you're being kind, you know, that you are kind. You're expected to articulate something meaningful about kindness more than you're expected to, you know, operate in the world in a kind way. I think it's really tricky. And there's an Audre Lorde quote that I'll probably butcher a bit, but she said...
That's okay, I do that all the time on here.
to paraphrase, she said something like, the white fathers told us, I think, therefore I am. And the black mother tells us, I feel, therefore I can be free. Mm. And I think, I think it really is. I think you can adapt that in so many ways, you know, apart from just feeling, but there's something, you know, about the life of a woman about the life of most women and most socioeconomically neglected and oppressed people that has demanded a being, you know, has demanded a doing that is really valid in terms of how you are spiritually formed and encounter the spiritual. So much to learn. I think about this as well with children, you know, the wisdom of children, and before they're able to even articulate, you know, what they know, the things that they know and that they're paying attention to, you know.
Yes. And the questions they ask as well, the things they know how to seek, that we so often tell them, like, or we kind of squash that down a bit and diminish it and say, oh, no, like, don't think about that. When actually, like, giving them the space to think about those things is what we should completely be doing.
Yes, yes. I mean, children, like you said, the questions, and there's this confidence that you have to ask a question, this kind of sacred confidence that you've been able to find something, you've been able to find the unknowing in you, and then say you desire something or you're curious. I think there's so much courage in the curiosity of children, and so much amazing brilliance and how they operate in the world and with nature and how they play, that we have so much to learn from. But when we're trapped in these concepts of thought and, you know, the cognitive project being the most important one, when we're trapped in that, I think we lose sight of all of, you know, these other forms of wisdom that are in our presence.
Well, I feel like I'm very much a learner on that scale. Like I feel like I've been very devoted to my kind of cognitive development all my life, and I'm gradually learning to be more embodied and to seek different ways of knowing. And it doesn't come easy to me, I won't lie, but I totally see the value in it, and I'm just full of admiration for people who do move through the world as a body, you know, rather than a little kind of mind cloud floating above this useless kind of flesh encasement. That's how I've often thought about my flesh encasement anyway. I could talk to you forever, and I wish we could, but I'd like to just ask you about one final thing so that I don't take over your entire life. It's tempting though. But recently you've written in The Atlantic, I think, about a different relationship with silence and about staying quiet sometimes and sometimes not feeling obliged to speak up about everything. Could you talk a bit about that? Because I, again, kind of strongly related to what you were saying there.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So before I began Black Liturgies, I didn't have too much of a social media presence. I mean, I didn't have Twitter. I didn't understand kind of the culture and all the ways it kind of, all the pressures of it. I was extremely naive about it. I only followed like friends and family and not these like brilliant thinkers or news anchors or people like that. So it all felt very new to me. And I'll have people, you know, when something tragic happens or something tragic is trending, well-meaning people message me and, you know, ask me, are you going to write about this? Why haven't you said anything about this? I mean, I think because I was so new to the experience, I was maybe able to become more critical of what was happening to me. So I was thinking, how strange, like this wouldn't be asked of me in person, you know, over if I was having coffee with someone, they wouldn't. And at the end,
what do you think about this? Can you pretend to me on this? Yeah.
Surely no one would, you know, criticize me, but there is this real, I think, current, this cultural current and this formation really that is telling us that when something bad happens, that we must comment on it.
Yeah.
I personally think the summer of 2020 and the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, that and Ahmaud Arbery and Elijah McClain, and I could go on. Something about that moment, I think, maybe tipped the scales or did something to where if you didn't comment on a thing, it meant that you did that thing. You know, you're just as guilty as the hand that pulled the trigger.
Yeah, that you're somehow culpable of. Yeah, yeah.
And yeah. I think that really did some damage to everyone's psyche and to everyone's, you know, the demand that requires, the demand we place on ourselves to have something articulate or meaningful to say in response to the war and the invasion of Ukraine, you know. Yeah. And I, in that Atlantic article, I say, you know, on February 23rd, like, I couldn't have pointed out Ukraine on a map. And I'm expected to, you know, craft some meaningful statement, which really would be, if I'm honest, it would have been a work of theater. It would have been theatrical because I knew so little. And I knew I needed to read, and I knew that there were other voices, in fact, that would, it'd be much more appropriate, you know, voices who know more, you know, it'd be much more appropriate to allow them to kind of have the air, you know, at least for a little while, you know. But it was the next day and people were asking me to comment. And so I'm very suspicious of this. I don't think that there's, you know, I'm not so suspicious that I think there's something wrong in commenting. You know, certainly if you feel drawn to, or you feel like you have something that you need to process, or I think that's beautiful and good. But what if you don't? And is that okay? And I think silence, I think silence does something. It allows you to really become honest. You know, I say to halt the theater and to ask yourself, or hear rather, to listen to, are you angry? Are you sad? Do you feel nothing? You know, silence, that's where I can be honest and say, I feel nothing. And I want to feel something, you know. I think silence can do so many things. And we've taken, I mean, I've done this, I'm guilty of this, the words of very brilliant, you know, Black ancestors, we've taken them so far to heart about silence. And I mean, really oppressed people throughout history have made really beautiful remarks on the violence of silence. I mean, we've talked about this some here, but I think, what does it mean to nuance that, you know? And I think that that's been my journey a little bit, this silent, you know, this silent little girl, this restricted girl, this then becoming this, kind of in resistance to the violence and the oppressive form of silence and wanting to really live in my own voice. And then also coming to reacquaint myself and, is there something beautiful in it? Is there something that I'm able to hear in silence that I would otherwise, you know, be completely unaware of? And I think the answer is yes.
Well, I mean, it seems to me that what's so obvious is that that little girl who was choosing not to talk was listening and watching and understanding in a way that other people were not, that there it is right now. Like, you are the embodiment of the value of sometimes just, you know, choosing silence in a positive way.
Yes, I do think it's possible. And I think we have a lot to learn from people who are able to practice it, you know, when they're under great pressure. I think we have a lot to learn from that kind of silence. And you know, the rest of just pacing around the perimeter of my house and in silence, like what kind of formation that offers me, that allows me to then meet the tragedies of the world, not from a state of, you know, an impoverished spirit, but one that's kind of awake and alive and, you know, not just concerned with the sound of my own voice, you know.
Yeah. I just think that's such wisdom for our age. And I've been gradually reversing out of Twitter, having been there right from the start, actually, and loved, you know, as somebody who felt very isolated in the world and very different to everyone else without understanding why, there was a time when I was so grateful to flow into that space and find other voices like mine. And like I can't even explain to you the release of that, actually, to be understood, truly understood, like for what I was. And then there came a phase when I felt overwhelmed by it, but also that I was taking part in an important act of witnessing, you know, that it had put me in contact with the many, many scratchy truths of the world that were uncomfortable to see, but that I understood life on a more micro level. And you know, Twitter is just full of voices calling out to be heard. And I think it's a really mixed blessing to be able to hear them. And it's the first time in history we've been able to do it. And it's changed us. It's changed us for the better.
Yes.
But there's also this pressure to go in and perform anger every day.
Yes.
At completely outrageous things. You know, don't get me wrong. It's not that I don't think those things are worthy of anger, because they're awful and infuriating. But I am not living a good life if I'm just going out and spouting rage in every direction every yes. single day and being taken up by that. Like, it's useless to me, and I'm useless to the world through that fury that just generates itself. You know, it's like this big inferno and as soon as you're not angry, everybody's angry with you, which I think yes. is what you were saying.
Yes.
And so I'm stepping away, and I've got mixed feelings about that, because I do think that some of the things it's thrown in my path have been good for me to be rattled by. You know, that mm-hmm. unsettled feeling that it often gives me is right. I should feel unsettled by those mm-hmm. things going on.
Yes. Yeah. I feel we have similar feelings about Twitter. You know, everyone criticizes Instagram, and, you know, I find Twitter just so painful. You know, I made the mistake of scrolling through Twitter just before we had our conversation.
Oh, dear, sorry.
And I was on my laptop. I thought, why am I doing this? I came across this horrible, very sad video, and, you know, the kind of ripping in and out of these kind of tragic moments, you're scrolling, the kind of, it's a real emotional labor to kind of pull yourself into the tragedy of, you know, Afghanistan, and, you know, the little girls not being able to return to school. And then I scroll and I see, you know, Kim Kardashian and Kanye West, and the next post is, you know, about face cream, and it's then the next post is about another Black person, you know. It's a real emotional tug that I think we haven't been able to adapt to yet.
I don't know if we have the equipment, you know. I don't know if we've got the brain structure to deal with, as you say, like desiring face cream and believing that it will solve all your problems next to the death of a child and yes. a political injustice, and then a hilarious bit of gossip. Like, I don't know if I've got the capacity for that, honestly.
Yeah. I don't know if I want to. You're right. Like, do I want to have the capacity for that kind of transition, and that, what is that doing to me, you know? Yeah. And so, I mean, I've had to find ways, and it sounds like you're figuring this out as well. I'm trying to find ways to kind of set up these, you know, these boundaries in my life, because I'm really concerned about how I'm being formed as a public presence on these apps, as a human on these apps. I went and got a dumb phone shortly after starting Black Liturgies. I got rid of my smartphone because I just felt like so much was changing about me so quickly that I thought I would be immune to. You know, you think, you know, once you know the threat, you're immune to it. But, you know, these structures, these systems are very smart. So anyways, I now, you know, I go on Twitter on my laptop, which creates a bit of distance as opposed to carrying it with me. There's a silence throughout my day. I know it's a very privileged thing to be able to have a dumb phone. You know, I don't think that's really practical for most people. I live in a very small town. I don't need directions often. So, but I mean, it's been so wonderful and so healing for me to not be carrying around the noise of the world with me, you know, all day long, to carry that. It's heavy.
All the world's pain in your pocket.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's heavy. Oh, Cole, thank you so much. It was just the most wonderful conversation. And
thank you.
I mean, I love where we've got to, because I'm now about to say to everyone that they should find you online.
And here we are.
Yeah. And that just neatly encapsulates where we are, because we're going out and we're looking for wise minds like yours, and we're trawling through a whole lot of other stuff in between. But I just, you know, thank you so much for your wonderful book, which I'd recommend to anyone, This Here Flesh, and for this brilliant conversation today.
Thank you. And thanks for inviting me into your space and trusting me with your listeners. So,
oh my goodness, always.
Thank you.
I'm standing next to the most magnificent herring gull. I know you're technically supposed to hate herring gulls if you live by the sea. They are the seagulls that come and aggressively steal your chips. But I think they're magnificent birds. They take 3 years to mature. And so you can tell roughly how old a herring gull is when it's under three. This one is a year two juvenile. The first year are kind of big and puffy and speckled. And then the second year, they're still speckled, but their wings are blacker and they just look a bit skinnier and leaner. By the third year, they'll have their incredible, pristine white feathers that always look so neat and tidy. Bert always calls them nosebleed gulls because they have a little red spot on their beak that looks like their nose is bleeding. It's quite a good way to identify them, actually. Anyway, this gull, who is a couple of metres away from me and looking me dead in the eye in a challenging way, has only got one leg. But he's styling it out. He's landed on one of the groin posts. He's standing there looking for all the world like he could come and take my chips if I had any. Wouldn't fancy my chances against him. It's part of the amazing stuff that you could notice in this world. It's always there waiting for you. I just love the way Cole Arthur Riley talks about that big, heady mix of suffering and life's challenges and the weight of history and political anger mixed with wonder and awe and all those simple emotions that we're longing to feel, and how we contain it rather than anything external to us. If you haven't read this here Flesh, don't be put off if you're not a reader of spiritual books. Seriously, challenge yourself, give it a go. Park your cynicism, park your skepticism, and just immerse yourself in her beautiful writing. I just love her prose. And I love the way she made me see the world we live in for a little while. I can't give you any stronger recommendation than that. Read it. It's a beautiful cover too, if that helps. I like a good cover. I'm going to head home and cook everyone dinner in a minute. But I just wanted to thank you for being here. I feel kind of good about the world at the moment. Well, I feel bad about the actual world. The world is full of dreadful, dreadful stuff. But I kind of always notice in these moments when we're all despairing that amazing compassionate quality of our despair. It gives me hope every time. I can't help it, I'm an optimist. I always admire the way we survive and take care of each other, even when we're urged not to, and even when we're told it's silly and that we should look away and that it's not our responsibility. We reach out. I just love that about us. We can't stop, and we shouldn't, ever. So I need to say thank you to everyone who helps making this podcast. To the producer, Buddy Peace, who composes the music. And to Megan Hutchins, who we've been trying to find a title for, because Megan is my virtual assistant. She puts so much in place in my world and just like helps me endlessly to cope. But she has such a pivotal role in this podcast. She looks after all the guests. She makes sure they're really well informed, that they're looked after, that they know where they should be. Fills in big gaps that I leave there. And she makes sure that me and Buddy are all well coordinated and motivated and that we know what we're doing. And so we have recently entered into the British Podcast Awards. I'm telling you that as an act of vulnerability, because I don't suppose we'll even get listed. We're competing against much bigger podcasts, but I wanted to put us in there because I'm really proud of what we do. And I know there's loads of you who love this podcast, and I love that you love it. And I love making it. Anyway, I had to put a title for Megan, and we've decided that she is the podcast's convener, which maybe isn't perfect, but I love that there's a role there for someone who is helping everyone together, helping everyone to get together. It's kind of a soft, gentle thing that she does, but she does it so well. Anyway, that's my tribute to Megan today. I'm very lucky to have the team behind me that I have. And she helps me to manage my brilliant Patreon community, who this month, as a special, are getting a reading clinic. I'm going to do my best to help everyone to understand how to get their reading mojo back, or where to find that elusive next book when you're a bit stuck. I've been really stuck with my reading for a long time, and I'm just coming out of it again. I'm feeling that urge to rush through loads of books now to kind of eat them whole, and I want to help other people back. So if you're not a member of the Patreon community, consider joining. Come and talk to us. We're really friendly. It's really lovely. And I've got some interesting plans for the future there too. Watch this space. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Cole, for a brilliant conversation. And I'll see you all next time. Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.